This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 93rd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. I've tried to think of a theme that links the strands of this show, but you know what? I can't really find one unless some rather interesting radio and some excellent music counts as a theme. Let's settle on that and cut to the chase. The chase featuring the following. We'll investigate how Mali's famous and profitable music industry is faring in the face of the country's trouble and strife.
All the artists were stuck. We had to stay at home. Yet public events are how we make a living. It's how we eat. There were no concerts for a year, so we tried to play at weddings to add a bit of atmosphere. But even there, the police would come and arrest us.
We'll talk to one of pop music's most amazing brains and most influential producers. You might have heard of the Beach Boys. We get into the mind of Van Dyke Parks.
I am 9/11. I am oil spills. I am eco catastrophe. I am deeply happy, but darkly informed.
And we'll delve into the pages of a charming and ingenious travel guide based on fiction as well as fact.
People don't tend to frame their lives in encapsulated texts, do they? They just live them. So it was about reminding people that if you put parentheses in this area, it's actually a really beautiful story.
Plus, this week's glorious live session comes courtesy of Nashville's Silver Seas. We'll ask why no one in Hong Kong wants to pick up a book despite its blossoming annual book fair. And we'll meet the street artist Thierry Noir, whose canvas is no longer the Berlin Wall, but the walls of a five-star hotel. Knots to get your teeth stuck into on this week's Culture Show with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Music, like a selfish lover, comes first here on The Culture Show, as you faithful listeners will doubtless know. Nothing to do with my personal predilection, you understand. Today we present a wonderful live Midori House session from Nashville's Silver Seas, aka Daniel Tashian. He came in and played tracks from the new record Alaska, and here he is with the title track.
Took a picture of you there by the side of the road, red flannel shirt and a sad look in your eyes. Spring of 91, you were the dancing girl. I was the kid behind the drums. You said, don't be so shy, if you don't mind. It's not emotion, 'cause everybody knows the length I would go to put my arms around you in mountains in the snow. I'd love to stay in the coldest state, but summer's gone and I must go. Alaska, I'm coming home. You said I lost my way, I took another step. And if it snows all day, well, don't be so surprised. All winter long, cold water in the tap, reading books on the stairs, and the radio played Gypsy. Alaska, don't you miss me? It's not emotion, it's not emotion, 'cause everybody knows the length I would go to put my arms around you, your mountains in the snow. I'd love to stay in the coldest state, but summer's gone and I must go. Alaska, Alaska, I'm coming home. Ooh.
That was Alaska, performed by Silver Seas. Two more tracks to come in the show from them, and a chat with Daniel Tashian, all worth waiting for. Right, we're crossing now to Mali, where campaigning is currently in full swing. The country goes to the polls on Sunday to elect a new president. There's a lot of criticism of the electoral process, but interestingly for the country's musicians, the race for presidential power involving 27 candidates is the best news for a long time. For a nation that's given the world music legends like Ali Faka Touré, Tounami Diabaté and Salif Keita, the events of the past 18 months have been devastating. Established names like Amadou and Mariam have been able to continue touring internationally. But younger musicians have simply been unable to play, first due to the imposition of Sharia law in the north of Mali, then because a state of emergency banned large gatherings of people. Alex Duval Smith reports from the political rallies of Bamako and Kulikoro, where music is once again being heard.
At the Mamadou Konaté Stadium, supporters of candidate Racine Thiam seem to have gathered the 5,000 people they were hoping for his first rally. An interesting candidate, he's never run before and is a telecommunications executive who's attracted three top rap groups to play here: Penzi, Iba One and Master Sumi. The average age here is 25. After a display by teenagers doing wheelies on mopeds and quad bikes, Racine Thiam, ever playing the youth card, takes the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear compatriots, we're going to build a new Mali. A new Mali where it'll be good to live. A new Mali where children will go to school and be given health care. A new Mali with more opportunities for women. A new Mali where youth employment will be a central concern.
In a country like Mali, which is one of the world's poorest and where illiteracy among women runs at 70%, a politician can promise almost anything and get it right. Candidate Haidara Aissata Cissé, known as Chatto.
For the youth, a Marshall Plan for Jobs, 500,000 jobs. A programme of excellence to rebuild education and training. A guaranteed fund of 50 billion CFA francs to finance the economic activities of young people, women and farmers.
Given the similarity of the 27 candidates' pledges ahead of Mali's election on the 28th of July, having a good musical lineup at rallies becomes all the more important. Candidate Chatto has her own muse, Timbuktu musician M. De As. The style is called Golden Songhai, a tribute to Chatto's northern Malian roots. M. De As is an established artist who, along with all musicians in Timbuktu, had to flee southwards when Islamist militants occupied the city in 2012.
It was around 4, 4.30. I could see people screaming everywhere. They were outside my house in their pickups, more than a dozen of them, armed. They were dressed in Islamic dress. They wore turbans. They took my instruments. They went off and burnt them. A child took my guitar and smashed it up. But I couldn't do anything. There was a gun pointing at me.
M. De As was taken to the rebel headquarters in Timbuktu. He was questioned, then left for a day and a night, uncertain of what would happen next or what was being inflicted by the Islamists on his musician family back home.
They said, "Tell the truth." I said, "Yes, but I'm an artist. What harm can I do?" They said, "Singing is not in the Quran. A Muslim must not sing. It's haram." I said, "I haven't become an artist to challenge God or to harm anyone. I didn't know it was harmful." They said, "Someone who sings, you cut off his tongue. Like someone who steals, you cut off his hand." They kept me all day, and the next day, the imam of Jingarebe Mosque came. They all came from the mosque and intervened.
The religious leader's intervention probably saved M. De As's life. Once free, on the same day, he found a friend with a motorbike, and they fled 1,000 kilometres to the capital, Bamako. Rapper Mano Di Ghetto also played at Chatto's Kulikoro rally. He was paid 50,000 CFA francs, that's about €75, for his appearance. He says that even for musicians who haven't had to flee from the north, the past year has been tough.
Avec la crise, avec l'état d'urgence et tout.
With the crisis, especially with the state of emergency, all the artists were stuck. We had to stay at home. Yet public events are how we make a living. It's how we eat. There were no concerts for a year, so we tried to play at weddings to add a bit of atmosphere. But even there, the police would come and arrest us. So it's been hard, very hard.
Veteran rapper Aziz Wonder's song lauds Tiebele Drame, but on Wednesday, Drame pulled out of the race for the Malian presidency, citing irregularities in the voters' roll and a security situation in the north that'll make it too dangerous for many people to go to polling stations on the 28th. Nevertheless, the rallies in the run-up to polling day have kick-started the music scene after the crisis. Music is back in Mali. For Monocle in Bamako, I'm Alex Duval-Smith.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Up next, we'll be meeting Van Dyke Parks, so don't go away.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Maranushi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. In a moment, we'll be crossing to Hong Kong, but first we're staying here in studio to meet a man best described as a musical enigma. Van Dyke Parks is the musician, lyricist and producer who, since the 1960s, has laid rich orchestration and quirkily lyrical takes on the American dream. He's worked with artists as diverse as Joanna Newsom to the Beach Boys, the latter of which he was an integral part of the mythical, seemingly lost and completed half a century later classic, Smile. Parks recently released his first new album in 18 years called Songs Cycled, not to be confused with his 1968 album Song Cycle. He stopped by Midori House and sat down with Tom Hall to talk about it.
I was 24 when I made Song Cycle. I'm now 70 and this is Songs Cycled. And yeah, sure, it reflects on that, but that wasn't what I was driven to do. Although I'd like to always go out the way I came in, that isn't a physical possibility. It is musically what I'd like to do.
Just starting back at Song Cycle, when I hear that record, it seems to be not only an attempt to distill much of American life, but to me it feels like a bit of a microcosm of Los Angeles itself. There's a lot of locations, you know, such as Laurel Canyon and Vine Street mentioned in it, whereas the new record, as far as I gather, it touches on things as diverse as 9/11 and the Prestige oil spill I saw. When you were making that record back in the 60s, were you still trying to say something about the wider world? Or
No. It's very simple. In Literature 101, when I went to school and they were talking about writing, the rule one is write what you know. So there's no conscious attempt at being autobiographical. But in fact, every work is inescapably autobiographical. This is who I am. I am 9/11. I am oil spills. I am eco catastrophe. I am deeply happy but darkly informed. Songs Cycled reflects that. It's wrapped in a very attractive, seductive cover, but that is really a coating to protect the casual observer from the darkness that lies within, which is basically, unintentionally, a caution to youth.
Constant commentary by the wayside. Nowadays, them country boys don't cotton much to 1, 2, 3, 4, kid.
more recently, you've collaborated and produced for the likes of Joanna Newsom and, you know, in the past, Rykuda and people like that. I mean, you're very much known, I think, as a collaborator. When you make a record like this, is that a feeling of sort of shaking off that tag a bit? Because you have your own voice. You don't want to be just known as that guy who makes things happen and makes things work. Is that something you feel?
It is liberating in a way, and also frightening, to be the voice. It's much easier to be behind the curtain, and that's where I usually am. Being noticed brings great risk, and that comes with the dinner with this. But at the same time, I think doing a record, doing an album, and these songs, in spite of anybody's misgivings about their being in demo form and singles, and they were last year, I put them out as singles to get noticed. They're all entirely new as far as I'm concerned. Every time I perform them, there's a great sense of novelty. Every performance is orchestrated differently. There's a lot of handiwork in what I do. It's not just by the seat of the pants. It's both seat of the pants and core, a heartfelt endeavor. Everything I do, whether it's being noticed or not being noticed, I put my entire heart into it. It's life-defining, working for Joanna Newsom, Rufus Wainwright, Scissor Sisters, U2, I mean, Natalie Cole, Randy Newman.
I wanted to actually know the record, the infamous record, Smile, because you collaborated with Brian on the finished version, which came out about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yes.
How do you feel about the version of Smiley Smile, the original kind of half-finished, kind of almost slightly frowned upon by, I think, the Beach Boys? Is that right?
I mean, I didn't listen to it.
You didn't hear it?
No, and I don't really, you might think that this is highfalutin kind of an arrogant remark or flip. But I don't listen to what I've done. I enjoy doing it. My heart is in the work. Everything else is beyond my control. What people might say. I'm not daunted by flattery. I'm still alive. I faced some Job-like adversity from press that couldn't easily compartmentalize my work. I'm just another guy who's doing music. And I tell you, there's something that really dogs me about this whole thing about infamous music or famous music. It's music. It's not munitions. Why should we say that we don't like Andrew Lloyd Webber? The guy is not making bombs. So I think that we must forgive musicians. I think I have every right to make these public declarations and records, and I'm proud of them all. I've been very fortunate. The work I did for Brian Wilson, for example, man, am I lucky that it came out at all. I'm so fortunate. There's so many people of superior ability never get to hear a note. So I was lucky to meet Brian Wilson. In the long run, it turned out to be, although not the big hits that I had hoped for, I wanted to write Help Me, Rhonda. I really did want to write those lyrics. But those melodies weren't there. It was a different item. He was in pursuit of something else. He wanted out of the box, and I had a key.
Song Cycled is an album that you can very, I guess, firmly say that you've finished, wrapped up, and it's ready for everyone to hear, right?
I think it's music for our time and of our time, and I think that it speaks to things that matter. But it is, I think it's a terrific entertainment. And I think it's beautiful.
That was Van Dyke Parks talking to Tom Hall. And if you want to hear that beautiful new album, Song Cycled, it's out now on Bella Union. This is Culture on Monocle 24, where now we cross to China. The annual Hong Kong Book Fair wraps up this week, and it's estimated already that a record 1 million visitors attended the event. It's mostly locals and tourists from the Chinese mainland who come to snap up titles that may well be banned at home. But while the event is getting bigger every year, the city's literary scene doesn't seem to be growing alongside it. Samuel Chan from our Hong Kong bureau went to find out why so few people in Hong Kong are choosing to read for pleasure.
Even before the age of the smartphone, it has never been easy to spot a passenger reading a book on public transport in Hong Kong.
The city may have one of the biggest book fairs in Asia, but Carmen Kwong, editor-in-chief of the free Chinese language magazine Books For You, says it's not books that Hong Kongers are after when they turn up.
It's a big party for them. It's simply like all of us going to the New Year's Eve marketplace. Okay, not that I want to buy any flower, not that I don't want to, I want to buy anything. It's simply because I just want to be there. Perhaps to Westerners, they may find, oh, this is strange, because how could an event having a million people going, and that is book related, which means they might have a huge book market in Hong Kong. And as a matter of fact, that is not true.
In a city like Hong Kong, which is lacking in a strong literary culture, bookstores often need to go the extra mile. As Annabella Lee, managing director from one of the city's oldest bookstore chains, Swindon Books, explains.
Well, the activities we have in our stores are not just for authors who write literature. We have, for example, photography, travel photographer. He's very well known. And when he came to our store, what we wanted was attract people who were photographers, who were interested in photography. So many people came, and he talked about how much time he spent waiting for one scene or teaching people how to take better photos when they are traveling. So with these events, we hope that people who don't really normally read would be interested and find out that actually many of the things that they are interested in are in books, and then they begin to turn towards books to enjoy and better themselves in what they want to do.
Hong Kong is among the world's most developed economies, and illiteracy here is almost extinct. But the majority of the population never seems to have the time or the inclination to read. A survey by a local research institute last year found that less than 6 out of 10 Hong Kongers aged 15 or above read as a habit. For Carmen Kwong, it all comes down to that age-old problem: the city's prohibitively high property prices.
Just imagine, okay, if you need to get your own place, if you want to just get a tiny little apartment in Hong Kong, you may have to spend half of your life in order to build up this Mickey Mouse apartment for you to stay. Otherwise, you may have to stay under the same roof with your family, with your parents, with your brothers and sisters, or even with your working colleagues. People in such a little tiny place, you have no choice but to work maybe more than one job in order to accumulate your wealth to build up your first home. Okay, so under this situation, they will have no time for us to think of art, to think of what we really enjoy, to think of our interests. Rather, our top priority will be our apartment. So I would rather, when I read, read something like that I can give me a fast track either in my career, either in my studies, either to give me a career advancement. I'd rather read something like that rather than I would read something that I really enjoy myself, or like a novel or something art related.
How children in Hong Kong are brought up may also explain why many never seem to acquire a love for books. Pierre Wong, executive director of Bring Me a Book Hong Kong, a non-profit organization helping children access quality books, thinks the Hong Kong education system puts too much emphasis on exams.
As opposed to reading to learn, reading to understand the world, that's really what is ultimately the main point of reading. But the focus is really on academic results, even from preschoolers and kindergarten age, is directly to do with how they can do well in exams and tests. That sucks out the interest and an enjoyment of reading. If you have a fun and engaging time with the child and you make it like a really special bonding time with the mom or the dad, and the teacher can really be silly and have fun with the books and the kids, that will ignite their love of reading for life. We conducted a research and found that Hong Kong actually has the lowest rate of family literacy in the developed world. And that was pretty shocking for a cosmopolitan city that we live in. So to address this, not only did they set up Bring Me a Book, but in 2009, we actually set up the Feng Zikai Chinese Children's Picture Book Award, which really rewards the best Chinese authors and illustrators in, you know, children's in, for children's books. So, you know, we really see that the need to promote, you know, the good quality books, but also hand in hand with that is just educating the parents and teachers and caregivers on how to make reading fun.
And with such huge numbers in attendance at this year's book fair, the potential is there. The challenge now is to help them see reading as an enjoyment rather than as a chore. For Monaco in Hong Kong, I'm Samuel Chan.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we'll be getting some music and wisdom from the Silver Seas frontman Daniel Tashin. We'll meet the man who's published a travel guide with a difference, and we'll hear why street artist Thierry Noir has moved his latest work inside. Why turn on the TV when you can enjoy our theatre of the mind here on Monocle 24. Okay, so first time for a little bit more music from the Silver Seas. Daniel Tashin stopped by recently to play us some tracks from the new record Alaska, after which I stole into Studio 2 with him for a quick chat. First up, here he is with I'm the One.
You're the one with flowers in your pretty hair. You're the one who pretends don't really care when I know you do, because I'm the one that loves you, can't you tell? I'm always waiting in your life. I'm the one who's here for you, baby, you know I'll always be your guy. And when I see you, oh, I can still see you more each night when I go out. You're the one I hope will walk in the door. I know you will, because I'm the one that loves you, can't you tell? I'm always waiting in your line. I'm the one that's here for you, baby, you know I'll always be your guy. Till I'm the one on your mind. There may be other guys, they may tell pretty lies, but they don't know you, they don't know you like I do. Waiting in your light. I'm the one who's here for you, baby. You know I'll always be your guide. I'm the one who loves you, can't you tell? I'm always waiting in your line. I'm the one who's here for you, baby. You know I'll always be your guide. I'm the one who won't ever stop believing until I'm the one on your mind.
The Silver Seas, in the form of Daniel Tashin, have just performed a beautiful, a haunting Midori House set for us. Daniel, cheers to that, by the way.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. We've got a little bit of, because it's summertime here in London, we've got a little bit of rosé.
It's taking all the boxes.
It's taking all the boxes. So that record, Alaska, that's out. It's a beautiful thing. I want to know, you recorded it, you went to Nashville this time to record this record. What happens in Nashville? Does the sort of ghost of musicians past haunt you, or does it inspire you, Daniel?
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up ghosts because, you know, I really do.
I
do believe in ghosts. Okay. And the way that I believe in them is I think when an artist makes a record, I think that they are, in the best case scenario, laying their sort of soul bare in the recording process and trying to be really open. And I think when artists are in that state of mind, you're vulnerable to paranormal influence, you know. And that's why a lot of artists will say, we recorded at some studio and it was haunted, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that every place is haunted. It's just when you're in the process of making a record, you're really more open to those spirits.
I think you are. Your ears and your eyes and your well, presumably also the chords you're laying down are open to the benevolent ghosts of
hopefully
whatever's
yeah.
happened in that studio. Why did you call it Lasker? Because it's a sort of warm sounding thing, this record.
Well, I like the idea of a place I'd never been, Alaska, and I like the idea of writing about a place I'd never
yeah.
been from a very romantic, over-romanticized kind of nostalgic way. It gave me something to shoot for and something to imagine. And it's not like writing about New York because, you know, you've been to New York and you know the reality of it. But Alaska still exists for me in this beautiful fantasy in my mind.
It could be a fictional place.
Exactly. And that I found that really inspiring because, you know, I go to sing about this place I'd never been. It was only what I'd seen in pictures or movies or like that movie The Proposal with Sandra
yeah.
Bullock takes place
yeah.
in Alaska. I mean, could you imagine a more beautiful place? I can't, but...
What happens? I ask this to a lot of musicians, but I'm always fascinated to know whether you can cut yourself off from listening to records while you're writing one, or whether it's a good
yeah.
thing. A lot of writers read a novel in the morning and write in the afternoon, so
yeah.
they're in a vibe, you know. How does it work?
Yeah, there is something to that. I can understand that. But also, I remember, you know, my wife trying to play me something. She was saying, you got to listen, there's a new Washed Out track. And I love Washed Out, you know.
Yeah.
And but at the time when she said there's a new track, I just didn't want to hear it right then because I didn't want it to sort of lay waste to my ethos. Because sometimes I can be really fragile is not the right word, but you don't want... If you're off on a track, you don't want to hear something that like totally shatters all your philosophies and
yeah.
you go, oh, shucks, that's what we should be doing, you know? And so I do like to protect myself a little bit in that process. And it's something I do instinctively because I know the pain of being in the middle of a project and then hearing something and wanting to just put the car completely in reverse.
Yeah,
and it's just not productive, you know?
What about the songwriting thing? Do things help the songwriting process? Do things help you get in a vibe? Well, maybe write the lyrics,
you know,
or write the music, or when you're jamming with the band, or when you're doing stuff on your own. Is it about an atmosphere? Is it about a vibe? Is it about getting in the space in your head?
Man, for me, it comes out of I'm pretty Nashville about the way I do it. At least this is the way most people do it in Nashville. But I mean, like, I'll tell you an example. Like somebody will say something, and I'm just like, that sounds like a song. Like somebody will say a title. You
yeah.
know? Like it'll just be dropped into whatever else they're talking about, and I have like a radar for titles, and then I'll just file that away in my phone or whatever. And then when I go pick up the guitar, I'll look for a little piece of music that seems like it goes with that thought, and sort of expand it from there. And that's pretty much how I do it, you know. But I think songwriting is a wonderful thing, and I think it's very normal to do. We have a 2-year-old daughter. She makes up songs all the time.
Yeah.
I think that the world sort of beats that instinct out of people because people get made fun of. But I think it's very normal for us to just think of melodies and to say and sing things. Tiger Lily does it all day long. She's always singing.
Tiger Lily's your daughter.
Yeah, she says stuff all day long. She sings things. She said, you know, she'll say, what's your name? You know, and I'll be like, where'd you get that? You know, and she just hums and...
She's a Nashville baby there. Come
yeah,
on,
but I also think if you can put your brain in kind of an innocent place where it's sort of open to the spirits
yeah.
and open to things, that it's not really that hard to write songs, you know.
But this is a record that's packed with melodies. I mean, this record sounds like a greatest hits record. I mean, this is an amazing thing.
Well, I'm always telling people, don't think that they're going to sound as good as me because I was really born with a kind of a golden voice.
And I'm joined by Daniel... Daniel Teschen, The Silver Seas, who was born with a golden voice.
That's right.
And if you want to hear that new album, Alaska, it's out now on The Lights or EMI. TheSilverSeas.net will tell you everything you need to know. One more track from Daniel at the end of the show. That's Culture with me, Robert Bound. So, you arrive in a place you've never been to before. But instead of getting out your generic travel guide to follow the well-beaten path of many a tourist before you, you call a number. On the end of the phone is your guide. You don't know their name, they could be of any age or profession, but they know that you're someone they can trust, and they're going to show you a new side of their town or city. Sounds interesting, right? Well, it's actually the premise of a new limited edition book called For You, the Traveller. There's only 200 in the world, hand-bound in Tasmanian oak and, intriguingly, salvaged rabbit fur. It's a collection of hand-drawn maps, ideas and stories from people based in locations spread across five continents who, if you buy a copy, will act as a port of call for you should you be travelling through their patch. The book is the creation of artist Nabil Sabio Azadi, who was passing through London recently and came into Midori House to tell producer Katie a little bit more.
It was almost a year ago to the day, actually. And I saw the whole thing fully formed, even the weird idiosyncratic typesetting and the fur for some reason. That is still beyond me, too. I don't know why it has a rabbit fur cover. I just obeyed the first instinct that I had.
So you just conjured up this image of the book and it
very
stuck
quickly
exactly to that image.
I started making it that night. 2 months later, it was open for pre-order.
You say it's a guide to the world with people who act as your guide. How exactly does that work?
Now, this is interesting because it can vary on a number of levels, provided that when you call this person, they don't think you're mad crazy and they decide that they'd like to spend some time with you. It could vary between a day spent with them out and about in a city somewhere. Maybe you'll stay with them, depending on if they feel comfortable with you. It could be a friendship. It could be something fun in terms of a way of passing a day, or it could be something more meaningful depending on how you respond to the text that they have in the book, because the texts are actually quite personal, aren't they? They're sort of like lessons learned in life, as it were. As I was making it and interviewing these people and helping them put together these texts, it began to occur to me that I was more or less making exactly what I wished I had had when I was sort of 17, 18 and feeling incredibly small in a really big world. And so to that end, I hope that it's something that people can read just as much as they can actually practically use to move about. What's interesting to me, actually, is now that it's had a chance to go into the world and people have had a chance to read it and interact with it and meet some of the people inside, a lot of people have commented that the text almost became more important than what they could use it to do and what they have used it to do. And that to me is really meaningful because it's something then that lasts much further than if someone changes the telephone number.
So is there a favourite one that you would like to read out?
Absolutely. So this is Mathieu Pitkovit from Paris. To direct you to his house, follow the Seine eastward, break north of the great wood Vincennes and onward to Montreuil. And he writes, after many years, I have finally come to believe that people are inherently good. Now, I work in an art gallery, so I cannot say this as an anthropologist or a philosopher. Rather, I say it as someone who is extremely apt at getting out of bed in the mornings. What I mean by that is that despite the multitude of reasons to fear the possibility of what might happen if I meet you, I do not fear you. I love you. For strength lies in knowing the unknown, and the winds of change tend to favor the sails of those who politely yell out to it, "Nice to meet you." You may telephone me on...
We'll keep his number a secret
For
now. But I just wonder how much direction you gave people when you asked them to write something for you when you were putting the book together.
This was really tricky. At the start, I had no idea how to accomplish such a personal thing because I know all these people really well and I know what they've gone through, but I was reluctant to put it on a plate and get them to sign off on it, as it were. So first I started off with some questions, but we ended up getting answers like, I really like walking in this park, something else, and there's a lot more depth to these people than just where they like to walk in the mornings. And so in some instances, I ended up having really long conversations with people, sort of recounting what it had been like when we first met, what they had been going through at the time. Oh, do you remember that thing? And wasn't that really incredible? Because of that experience, now you are where you are now, and this kind of thing. And then slowly people began to go, oh yeah, I do actually have this story to tell. People don't tend to frame their lives in encapsulated texts, do they? They just live them. So it was about reminding people that if you put parentheses in this area, it's actually a really beautiful story.
That's so interesting. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, which you hinted at there, was how you found these people.
Yeah, well, it's all completely random. Some people I met just by happenstance in normal daily life, walking down the street or at a bar. Then there are some more ridiculous stories like There's a female artist in there who's about 65 and she lives in Paris as well. And I met her because we were the only two people that reacted to a car crash that happened nearby us.
Wow.
And then there are people I've known since childhood. And there are people I met when I was sort of 14 and first traveling on my own in Europe. And there are people I ran into in America because I was stuck in the subway door. All sorts of things. But invariably, I ended up either staying with all of them or becoming really close friends with them. I pretty much speak to the people in this book more or less at least once a week, just as it happens in daily life.
Well, I thought it would be interesting, seeing as I have a copy of the book and I am, in theory, or could be, the traveller who this is addressed to.
Yes, ma'am.
I thought it would be interesting for us to meet some of these people. Who should we call?
Let's give Briar a go, because it's getting late in New Zealand, and I think she'd like to do it.
Okay.
Hello?
Briar?
Hey!
So, we've just been talking a little bit about the book, and we wanted to we wanted to hear about what it was like when you had your first call.
It was so lovely, actually. Her name was Kristen, and she was from Canada. She called while I was at work, and yeah, she just sort of explained that she was in Auckland and that she had actually met up with Nabil in Melbourne and was really keen to meet up for a drink or go for a walk or a coffee or something. She actually was really good. She gave me quite a big window of, you know, we got here today, we're going to be here for a week, and, you know, we can find a time hopefully in that week. So I invited her to meet at our house. I was talking to my boyfriend about it and I was like, oh my God, I just really want to make it something that's meaningful and memorable and really true to Auckland. And I think one of the most amazing things about Auckland is its proximity and accessibility to all of the beaches around in the water. And so I wanted to share that with her. I cooked up a big kind of dinner and took her and her partner down to a beach really near my house, and we sat and had a picnic on the beach for dinner while the sun went down, and they'd bought a couple of bottles of wine. So it was just exactly what you would hope for in this whole sort of spirit of what Nabil's created.
Thank you for being a part of For You the Traveller.
My pleasure. It truly is.
This is the kind of thing that could have worked on the internet. I mean, you could have set up a website where people sign up and they get people's details. It would have been really easy for lots of people to sign up
Absolutely.
And to communicate.
Yeah.
Why did you feel that you needed or you wanted it to be a physical book? What do you think that adds to it?
It's a really valid point. We live in a world where I really should have just made an app or something. And I've been asked to do it a few times and I keep refusing. I think I'm not alone in saying that objects can bear a great amount of emotion. And so I felt like to really get through to people that this had the potential to be something that wasn't just fun, but also potentially really life-changing and heartening, it seemed to me that I would have to go to some great lengths to make sure that from your very first interaction with the object, with the book, you felt a sense of wonder, maybe.
That was Nabil Sabio Azadi talking to producer Katie there. And if you're interested in grabbing a copy of the book for yourself, and remember, there's only 200, it's being sold in various hand-picked bookshops around the world, or you can visit the website foryouthetraveller.com. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Next, we'll be finding out why one of the world's most prolific street artists is now exhibiting work inside a five-star hotel.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nouns by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It seems that more often than not, art and its making come down to chance. Whether it's a spilt bucket of paint that may have given a Second World War veteran an interesting idea, or a discarded urinal that changed the face of contemporary art, some things unexpectedly make a mark. For graffiti artist Thierry Noir, it was a one-way train ticket from Lyon to Berlin in the early 80s that gave birth to his career. He became famed as one of the first artists to paint the Berlin Wall, on it, that is, and has since become a cult figure among galleries and street artists alike. But it's no longer just the street where the work can be found. Thierry is currently taking part in a group exhibition at the Norman Foster-designed five-star Me Hotel in central London. Monocle's Jack Flips heard he was in town and took the opportunity to find out how his career and the street art scene has evolved.
I moved from Lyon to West Berlin because I couldn't find my way in France. I took the one-way ticket to Berlin, so I had no return ticket, so I had to stay there. It was in January, very cold and grey. I couldn't speak any words of German, so it was very difficult at the beginning for me to survive. And then the luck for me was that I remarked everybody I met is an artist, so I jumped in that scene. So that's why I became an artist like that.
What was it like to live in Berlin? Was it difficult to be an artist?
I used to be a painter because the wall was just in front of my door. So I started to paint that wall at the beginning. I had no idea about political aspect and what it's about. But suddenly everybody wanted to know why I paint the wall. Who pay you? That's the first question was, who pay you? Who is behind you? Are you a spy from France, invited by the city of Berlin to make the world beautiful? And then I had to answer those sometimes aggressive questions. And I said, no, you can't paint hundreds of kilos of colors on the world, and the world will never be beautiful because it's a death machine. It's not a art project.
So you're looking out of your window and you see this vast, almost blank canvas of a concrete wall. How do you go about painting something like that? Did you just rock up with a bucket of paint and splash whatever you wanted, or did you have to sort of adopt some sort of ninja tactics under the cover of darkness?
At the beginning, I started to paint at night, but after 3 weeks in May 1984, I was photographed by the soldiers. So I decided to paint also in the daytime. It was, of course, illegal and quite dangerous because the wall was not the border. It was made 5 meters behind the real East and West border. So by painting on the wall, I was already in East Berlin.
And do you find it strange, or do you find it even surprising, that street art, graffiti, whatever you want to call it, has become so popular and so mainstream?
Yeah, it is very something new, I think. I don't understand what's happened, but it's like that.
Looking at your work specifically, I mean, you have this scheme that's going to be going ahead with Street Art London to be able to show people the arts of London, the graffiti scene. There's tours and you can make your own work. And looking at your work, what people can expect to see, you have a very definitive style. You have these particular types of character that look a certain way. There's, what is it, an 8 meter high one that's on the side of the Village Underground. Where does your character come from? Is that an evolution?
Yeah, I start to paint that style on the Berlin Wall because of those thousands of questions. I couldn't finish my work, so I developed one style which is possible to paint and talk at the same time. So this is the typical big heads. It's very, very radiophonic to explain a big nose, big mouth, big eyes. It was not an art project, that Berlin Wall. That's why, you know, there was a lot of emotion. Everybody had an opinion about that because it was a deadly border. 136 persons have been killed because of that wall. So, you know, it was not possible to ignore those questions. And then that's why I had to stop to paint and explain. And it was good for me because I never learned about the Berlin Wall at school in France. So then I start to make some research and to look what it's all about. And then I learned a lot because of that.
And I suppose to bring what you've just said back to the exhibition at the Me Hotel, if someone was going to go down there and they're not particularly massively aware of graffiti art, what do you think is one of the defining things that they should take maybe a saying or a feeling or a way of looking at it that would, to you, make sense?
Yeah, you don't have to be an expert to like it or not. I mean, if you don't like it, it's okay. I mean, I don't want to be, the big boss. But if you look at street art, especially now, you feel, I think, like a human being. You know, there's so much aggressivity in the city. So when you look suddenly at street art, so wow, you see, great. You know, you have 1 second of feeling, yeah, life is great.
That was Thierry Noir talking to Jack Phillips. And if you're interested in visiting Thierry's exhibition at the Mi Hotel in London, which also features BRK, Christian Nagel, Run and Zombie, The Outside In is on until the 4th of August. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be talking new build. No, not housing. It's that LCD Sound System meets Hot Chip band. Very exciting. They've got a new album out next week, and they're going to be telling me all about it. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher was her more than able assistant. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Silver Seas with As the Crow Flies. Thanks for tuning in.
Full moon shining down, the air is cold and dry, and my heart, like a weather vane, is turning. I'm reaching out for a melody, warm in the night. No friend or a bridge I was burning. Time, my love, it's time we go over the hills and through the snow. I was down in a moment, made out alive. We were young, you were in the seat beside me. In the dashboard light, I can see the lines around your eyes. You look restless and longing and troubled. Shackled with silence, has drifted into the distance as our wings take flight over the rooftops and the houses up below us.
To the bar.